Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. The law allows private enterprise to use paid advertising to promote who they are and what they do. With rare exception, governments cannot do that. As a result, we know very little about what work most public employees do, whether it's worth the money, whether they work efficiently or not. That in turn creates fertile ground for barroom experts and politicians to take pot shots at, quote, pointy-headed bureaucrats. I meet a lot of people in my work, and I think the one who's had the most interesting, diverse experience in the public sector is Rich Bechtel, recently retired from state government. He's seen a lot in government, good and bad, and we're going to talk about it. Rich, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Oh, thank you, Brian.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Oh, I'm an Air Force brat.
Really?
Lived all over the world, went to school in Germany and Spain, North Africa. I had a ball as a kid. But my dad was from Wolf Point, and his family had a small grocery store there that they lost during the Depression. But so that was our roots, and we came back to Montana when he retired.
How was that experience for you as an American kid in seeing all those cultures? Did it influence you, or were you on a military base where you were just with U.S. people?
It was both, but to be exposed to all kinds of cultures was fantastic. For example, in North Africa, the Arab cultures were very interesting, and The city that I lived in was Tripoli, Libya. It was flanked by two Roman ruins, and as a kid, you'd walk about these ruins, were perfectly preserved, and you'd look for flecks of green, and you'd stoop and pick up Roman coins. It was just a great way to grow up as a kid.
Wow. So when did you stop doing that?
My dad's last assignment was Glasgow Air Force Base, and it was my senior year in high school. We moved there from Spain, and then I went to the University of Montana.
What did you study there?
History. And thought I'd go back to Spain and study in the archives of the New World. I was very interested in that culture, being there in high school. But you really couldn't study that at the university. The archives were all American. So I studied with Dr. K. Ross Toole, who was a phenomenal mentor. And he had me do research that was available in our own archives. So I studied the election of 1920. And it was the first time that the companies didn't control both candidates for the election. It was Burton K. Wheeler and Joseph M. Dixon.
Now, this was an election for?
For governor. And one of the issues that was central to Mr. Dixon, I don't know if you remember, but Mr. Dixon was a very, very creative leader. He ran Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose campaign. He was a U.S. senator beforehand. He is the one who brought us the direct election of senators. He was a very famous progressive. Hmm. And in this election, he was raising constitutional issues that the Montana Constitution needed to be reformed, especially for executive reorganization and the way the legislature worked. And so I was very interested in that subject. And suddenly, lo and behold, the legislature in Helena passes a referendum asking the citizens of Montana whether they wanted to call a constitutional convention. And if they did vote for it, it convened a constitutional convention commission, which was to make the preparations for that convention.
Now, this was 1970.
70.
Now, how did that affect you?
I immediately, when I saw it passed, I wrote the commission a letter asking if I might work for them. And they hired me, and it was just a matter of just simply lucky timing.
Why did it interest you?
It interested me because of the issues that I was following in my MA thesis. And I also was very interested in just simply good government. And, you know, I grew up in high school with Kennedy and then Mr. Johnson in college. And there is a mentality that's in the air that affects people in different generations. Mm-hmm. And for me and most of my colleagues, it was Kennedy's statement of, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And that was in all of our minds. And so a lot of my colleagues, the very brightest colleagues, went into public service. And that was very interesting to me. And to be able to work on a constitutional convention was fabulous.
Why did what Kennedy said mean anything to you? Why did you care enough to go in that direction?
Because I'd seen poverty all over the world. I'd seen it in the cities in the East. And that was a major thrust, was the environment and also addressing poverty. There was a sense among my colleagues that if you had good knowledge and information and you talked to people, you could address any problem and solve it. That was just simply what we all believed at the time.
So you write the letter.
And I get hired. And like I say, they hired about 10 research analysts. And I was, I think, because I was probably the first, and because I had that experience, I was hired. Where my colleagues were true geniuses. Almost every one of them were the most exceptional people you can imagine to staff this commission. And I then got to associate with truly brilliant people, and of course it raised my game as well.
So the association is in the process of doing what?
The commission itself was to make all the preparations so that 100 delegates elected across the state could come in and within 90 days adopt a constitution. And my work and the immediate colleagues that I had, we took each major article of the Constitution of 1889, and we analyzed those articles of the Constitution and what worked, what didn't, why, what's happening elsewhere across the country. So I got to study all 50 state legislatures, their processes, and their constitutions. For example, the Montana Constitution, in its legislative article, did not require recorded votes, and meetings could be executive session so that people couldn't attend them, especially conference committees. There was also a time limit of 60 calendar days, and so towards the end of a legislative session, the legislators would throw a cloth over the clock as though it couldn't be seen, and they would go for multiple days after that. But it was very hard for citizens to track and understand what was going on. And so one of the major things this legislative article in the CONCON did is they adopted immediately rules to make the legislature transparent. All votes are recorded. All meetings are open. So it was a major reform. It's now a 90-day session every 2 years, but each legislature can change the length of that for the following legislature in case it becomes obvious that more time is needed.
So your actual work was to do the research, write a report to a committee of the convention so they could assess the alternatives and make a decision?
That's right. And then I staffed that committee and drafted the legislative article on their behalf, under
now
their
when
direction.
When you say the legislative article, the provision of the Constitution that describes how the legislature will work?
Yes.
Okay. Why did you give a damn about that?
Because the last two legislative sessions in 68-70 were very controversial, and they had a very difficult time getting work done. And so it was obvious in everybody's mind that the legislature could really use some reform, especially recorded votes.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Rich Bechtel about his experience in government. In your opinion, was the quality of the research that you and others did of the separate provisions of the 19th century Montana Constitution, then reviewed and by the appropriate committee in CONCON, the quality of the research and evaluation of the alternatives important to the outcome?
Oh, absolutely. Each member of that committee and each delegate, all the 100 delegates, received a copy of each of those reports. And whatever committee they were assigned to, they were able to thoroughly understand what the central questions were and what all the various states across the country had tried to make them the very best working legislatures possible.
So I'll ask you, as one of the key players in writing those reports, and thus influencing the outcome, 40-some years later, we have a functioning constitution in Montana. How's it worked out, in your opinion?
Beautifully, and it was because of the research, but even more importantly, those delegates were elected as partisans, and they chose, when they convened, to meet in a nonpartisan basis. And they sat together alphabetically rather than as Republicans and Democrats. And they had a very partisan chairman of the convention who was so impartial. He cut off no debate and made sure every issue was thoroughly debated. As a result, we had a very, very fine constitution. Today, it's still viewed as one of the two or three best constitutions in the United States. Only 3 years ago, I had the White House call me. They tracked me down, and they wanted to know, they had been queried by a couple of states, how would they prepare a constitutional convention? And I referred them to the great documents that that Constitutional Convention Commission had prepared, and then the document itself.
I think it's fair to say that partisan politicians today in the Congress and our legislature are not acting in a nonpartisan way, in contrast with what you've described. Someone might say that's their job. Their job is to represent their party. Others would say things work better when they take a nonpartisan approach. Do you have an opinion on which is better and why?
I think that the partisan approach is very important, but once they come to their debate and they make their decisions, they need to make those decisions on the very best information possible, and they look for the benefit of the whole community, the whole state, rather than a particular partisan view. And that's what those folks did. And that was the beauty of a lot of the work I experienced through my early part of my career.
So what was the early part of your career?
One of the most brief jobs I had, it was only 3 months, was immediately after the convention. And I was hired by the governor's Office of Manpower Training. And it was to implement the Economic Opportunity Act. And my job, I was given three researchers, and we were to review every state agency in Montana that received money that was going to disadvantaged people, low-income people, and determine how much of that money was actually reaching them. It was a most insightful job. In most cases, the money was being moved pretty quickly, but I learned two very important issues. One of the very first was I was interviewing a senior official in, I think, the Department of Labor, and I was asking him a series of questions, and he paused and said, "I'm sorry, but the interview is over." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, let me tell you, son, I have worked for three governors, and I plan to work for multiple more, and I'm going to be here long after your governor is gone, and I'm not going to answer any more questions." So my immediate lesson was that even when a governor is just trying to improve current law and the implementation of it, they can have a very steep and tough job.
Because people that governor cannot hire or fire hold positions from which they cannot be moved, and they're thinking their job is not to implement what this governor has to say, but maybe to hold on to their job?
That's right, and they may feel that they have a far better sense of the true nature of what their mission and responsibility is, and that maybe a governor is a newcomer and only going to be there a while. So they may be legitimate sometimes in that view. But what it taught me instantly early on was that a governor has some convincing to do when they try to implement reforms. The second issue was I learned that you can absolutely say anything with numbers. And so for the rest of my career, whenever I was given a list of priorities or a formula, and I was told it was neutral, the red flags would fly, because you can say almost anything with numbers. And one of the first things I learned in reviewing these programs was we encountered one that was for children, and the data made no sense that they were giving me, and I went home and I studied it multiple nights, and I finally came back and I learned that this program's data was rounded off at the nearest million children. Montana, in that year, did not have a million citizens, much less children. The data made absolutely no sense for us.
But it was being applied to get policy decisions based on its validity.
Yes.
So what I'm getting is you made the shocking discovery that in designing government programs and allocation of resources, the data better be solid, correct?
Absolutely.
We have a part-time legislature. I'm skeptical that they could take the time to determine whether data they're given is solid or not. Am I right? And if I am right, who should do it?
They almost always depend on the state agencies. And those state agencies are all quite often implementing federal law. And those formulas and the statistics are often developed at the federal level.
All right.
And so those agencies are the ones that make recommendations to the legislature in the hearings and in bill drafts. And they try to tell them this program is underfunding low-income children because of this reason. We maybe need more state funds to address this.
Well, another answer, it seems to me, might be we need to correct the data coming from the federal level, bring it to their attention, so that we get our fair share.
Yes. When we talk about a job down the line here where I represented the states, the three Montana governors in Washington, D.C., a lion's share of that work was looking at these federal formulas and making sure that they were being crafted in a fair fashion, because they were trying to change the federal highway funds, all kinds of programs that would have disadvantaged Montana and all of our rural neighbors.
So let's go through that. You're back there representing Western governors who want a foot in the door, an ear on the ground, right?
Yes.
All right. You look at the formula. It's going to shaft us because the numbers are wrong, not because we don't deserve it, but it's just the method of analysis is flawed. What did you do about that?
We informed all of our neighboring states of the effects. One of the things that we're jumping ahead, but the Northeast Midwest Coalition of all the legislators from those areas of the country, along with their banks and major industries, had proposed a bunch of federal changes to the formulas that would have moved more monies from the rural West, they felt the energy-rich West, to them. One example was they were wanting to change highway funds, which we really are dependent upon here, from lane miles to vehicle miles traveled. And that meant we have long distances in Montana and few vehicles, where if you're in New York, you can imagine how many miles are traveled in a commuting hour. But yet they have a lot bigger population to support those roads in those communities. Here we had less than 1 million people supporting 600 miles across the state. So it was a huge disadvantage to us. We were able to maintain that over those years to keep lane miles rather than vehicle miles used.
Okay, this first job is a state job, but you end up in Washington. How?
Senator Metcalf had a position open every year for a senior civil servant in Montana. His belief was bring someone back there and learn the issues that were confronting the federal congressional delegation, and they could then go back and be far more effective for the state government working there. And so I received the Metcalf internship, they called it. And while working there for him, the office director for the Montana governor's office at the time, Dean Hart, asked me to work for him and to bring the different techniques that I was learning in Metcalf's office to the state process so there would be a really strong partnership between the congressional delegation and the state government. And so my work was, what are our very best practices as things were coming up in Congress, and feeding that to our congressional delegation. And it was a fabulous experience. Mr. Metcalf was a great legislator, and he inserted in the major budget bill for Congress a requirement that OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, kept a list of all sections of law of when they were to sunset. And that list would go for 5 years out. And so every year I would get that list, and I would visit with my state agencies and learn what programs were going to be amended in the next 3 years. And we would try to do it 2 years out. So by the time Congress took up those provisions, we had very thorough legislative amendments and the rationale for those amendments. And it made our delegation, it was very helpful. It was their own information because we just took it to their staffs. It became theirs because they translated into the House member of the senator's needs and his committees of jurisdiction. And so They had very, very effective amendments, and we then had federal programs that were working better for Montana.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Rich Bechtel, who's had a rich political career in state and federal government and has just recently retired. Was that new, common, uncommon?
It was very unusual, and I taught several other states that whole process. And then eventually, I worked for Judge Swindon and then Stevens, and it became clear that we needed representation for more states than just Montana, because I was always having to go out to North Dakota, Wyoming, Idaho, Oregon, California, and say, this amendment affects you all. We need your help on the committee and then in the floor. And so eventually, Mr. Swindon convinced the Western Governors Conference to place an office in Washington, D.C. And I remained on the governor's staff, but then eventually I left it. But they did establish a Western Governors Association office. And some years later, I then ran it, and I applied all those techniques again for all of the 21 Western states. And it was a very effective time for about 10 years.
Effective in what sense?
Effective in being very, very creative in legislation on mine reform, water quality, the Endangered Species Act, all kinds of issues. We brought a very rich, rich best practices from the states and wove that into federal legislation.
You mentioned you did some work on Endangered Species Act. That obviously is a matter of major contention among different groups. What did you do with what consequence?
I had a process I developed for Governor Judge and used for the other governors in Montana that I applied there. And it was a process of being able to take every affected group that has a stake in an act, like ESA, irrigators, miners, state fish and wildlife agencies, federal agencies, all of those various entities. And I convened them in a series of steps in which they were very specific in legislative language. About their concerns and what was the solution. And out of that came a body of common ground. And that was introduced or supported by the Western governors, all 21 governors. And as a result, a bill was introduced in the Senate. It never passed the Senate floor. So when it did not move, because the Secretary of the Interior and his major staff were involved in the development of that common ground, they took all the provisions that didn't require a change in federal law, all the improvements to the act to make it work better in the field for all of those interest groups. He implemented that as a regulatory reform. And so that postponed major attacks on the ESA for about 12 years.
So at this point, you've been in Washington about 20 years, having worked at CONCON and at the state. If I asked you what you learned in that 20 years, what would you say?
The importance of thorough staff work, drawing on the best practices from a broad perspective as possible, as many perspectives as possible, and collaboration. And then in a respectful manner, where you really build trust with people. That's what made that job so important. The other is, in those jobs, is being on site, Brian, to be able to see as things evolve and be able to give people a heads up. It's invaluable to be there. When I said be there, I meant Washington, D.C. As federal agencies and Congress are enacting programs that affect Montana.
Interacting with the people doing that.
Yes.
Another aspect of your experience that strikes me as highly unusual in government is when you came back and worked for the state government, the Department of Revenue, and your experiences there. When did you come back? What was your job?
I started with the state again in 2008, and the department created or established an Office of Taxpayer Assistance, and that office had been created in 91, but never really filled. It had been dispersed.
Created by the legislature in 91 and never filled till 2008?
Yes.
Okay. You get the job. What's the job?
It's a fascinating job. It's to handle, the department is very skilled at handling issues as they arise, either with an auditor or a collector. And so they're very good at working with citizens. But occasionally there are issues, quite often, there are issues that they can't resolve. They can't be addressed through the normal process. So they were forwarded to that office. But the office also is there to discover systemic issues. And it's when taxpayers call and find a problem with the way we're doing something that allows us to see a flaw in a practice we may have been doing for 20 and 30 years. And so that office was alive to those kinds of issues. That was its responsibility. And then it would work with the director and the divisions that the issue arose in to address those so they worked better for citizens. An example would be our low-income housing program. It was designed in the late 60s to help widows and widowers and pensioners. And people, when they qualified, they filled an application out. It was ongoing. But if there was to be an income change, they were to self-notify us, and it would change their benefit. Over time, the department couldn't live with that feeling that it couldn't really be fiscally responsible. So it made the applications annual. And what happened then was a lot of these folks are very infirm or have other kinds of issues. They couldn't clear the paper process, the application process every year. So out of about 19,000 people, 4,000 were dropping out every year when they need it most. And so the reform that we put together was using data that we already have and collect that allows them to apply only once. And then we can go to our databases and approve or disapprove them based on the income that they're earning. So it was a far better way of addressing the needs of homeowners.
For more than four decades, you worked in government inspired by President Kennedy's statement. How does it look looking back?
It couldn't have been a better experience. I saw folks work together and a lot of problems solved. It was a wonderful career, Brian. I think that when there's cooperation and folks act from a good information base and they broadly consult, then government really works and addresses the needs of people. At the moment, elected officials reflect you and I. And at the moment, we tend to be electing folks who take pride in being divisive and not working together. And that will change because crises make folks have to cooperate again. And so we're about to see that again.
Rich Bechtel, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.